Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. In this lecture, recorded on February 11, 2018, at the National Gallery of Art, Joshua Shannon aims to recover the revealing strangeness of photorealist painting, a movement largely ignored since its heyday around 1970. Drawn from one chapter of Shannon's book, The Recording Machine, Art and the Culture of Fact, the presentation focuses on works by the California painter Robert Bechtel. Shannon uses Bechtel's paintings to teach us about the role of photography in shaping everyday experience after World War II, lingering on photorealism's account of modern surfaces and interest in the odd psychosocial phenomenon of posing. Shannon concludes by proposing a new understanding of the apparent anti-humanism of American art in the 1960s and 1970s.
There's a couple of prefatory notes I want to make before jumping into the heart of this topic. The first one does a little bit of work to just try to situate what I'm going to say today in relationship to the book as a whole. So I want to just give you for a minute or two a bit of a glance of the book at large so that the chapter here that I'm talking from will make some more sense. So what you'll hear this afternoon is drawn from chapter 3 of my new book, The Recording Machine, Art and Fact During the Cold War. The book is an effort to understand why so many artists in the Cold War West around 1968 seemed to reject art's traditional aims of revealing deep truths in favor of something like the mere presentation of unsynthesized information. The art involved in the book is quite varied, including conceptual photography, earthworks, and systems art, as well as photorealism. I'm especially interested in trying to analyze and learn from the complicated relationship between this art and the culture's much broader overall turn away from truth in this period in favor of fact. And I'd be very glad to talk afterwards about what may have happened in this overall history since this period. But in the Cold War period, one of the things I'm trying to diagnose is a kind of rejection of something like deep essential truth in favor of something called fact. That is, I want this art to cast light on the culture's technocratic effort to re-describe the world as nothing but that which can be observed, measured, and recorded. Needless to say, this cultural reorientation was largely propelled by modernity's long demotion of all things mythological in favor of science, social science, and empiricism. It was also propelled by what we might call the epistemology of the camera, that is, the camera's way of knowing things. The notion that the most accurate and reliable form of visual representation would amount to a good record of the surface appearance of those things. Within this book, then, this chapter on photorealism holds a rather special place. Photorealism, which at the time was also, still sometimes called either hyperrealism or superrealism. I prefer the term photorealism because it emphasizes that it begins from a photograph. But photorealism, which enjoyed about a decade of fragile art world credibility after 1968, is a form of making paintings by closely copying photographs, sometimes with the help of a projector. Photorealism, therefore, is where the long tradition of painting has most directly confronted the camera's way of knowing things. The ambivalent results of this confrontation have a lot to teach us, it seems to me, about what aspects of humanism are still credible or possible in our civilization now. More specifically, photorealism was an effort to come to grips with a new historical period in which surface seemed especially dominant. And it attempted, furthermore, to understand the relationship of this period to the last several centuries of human history. Okay, I promised a second prefatory note. This talk begins, as does my chapter in photorealism, as you'll see in the store. It begins with a brief but intensive look at one painting by Chuck Close. And in light of the recent allegations that many of you, of course, have read about or heard about, that Close sexually harassed women who posed for him, I, of course, wondered this week whether I ought to delete this portion of the talk or how to handle it. And in the end, I've decided to keep it. You'll see a painting by him for a few minutes now at the start of the talk. It seems to me this is a better option than passing over the work and the charges in silence. I want to stress that my doing so is not meant in any way to exonerate Close or to ignore these allegations. On the contrary, I hope that the few minutes that they offer us present an opportunity to reflect about this complicated question we're facing of the ethics of scholarship and museum practice as they intersect with human behavior, morals, and culture. So consider then Close's 1969 painting of Philip Glass. This is an insistently odd entrant in the history of portraiture. It's a 9-foot tall canvas based on a black and white photograph. Titled Phil, it seems to reject the foundation of the last several hundred years of portrait making. It's a picture of the surface of the young composer's face, a record of his physical appearance rather than an evocation or representation of his character, authority, or bearing. By dint of its giant scale, together with the harsh light and crisp photographic detail, the picture emphasizes the texture of Glass's skin, the form of his lips, and the curls of his hair. Most important to the effect of the picture is the harsh photographic instantaneousness of flash and shutter, made not from a lengthy sitting, but from a photo shot in a small fraction of a second. The picture is physical and specific rather than expressively general. Note especially how the uneven weight of the two eyelids, as well as the shadows of their lashes, materialize the eyes. But these eyes anyway belong to an instant without or between legible expressions. Glass does not communicate self-possession, but rather embodies an absent moment of staring vacantly into the middle distance. What we get with Phil is a single appearance made monumental, a giant fragment in black and white. The size of the painting, however, and the care with which it has been made seem to declare that this partiality is everything. Portraiture, having forsaken essence and truth, must now dedicate itself to appearance, to surface. But this painting is not merely an anti-Rembrandt. Compare it to another portrait of an artist, Arnold Newman's photograph of Alexander Calder, this sort of a National Gallery potpourri in some sense here, made only 12 years before. Like Close's painting of Glass, this one pictures a contemporary artist, indeed a white male culture celebrity with slightly unruly hair. It's also likewise restricted to black and white, and it relies on the camera's shutter and the indexicality of film. In the Calder portrait, however, the background is absorptive and lush, a silky universe from which the man and his art emerge definitively and together. Calder turns to acknowledge the camera, but his eyes, framed by a discriminating facial expression of slight distaste or disapproval, remain withdrawn and interior. Calder has brought his forehead down to meet his nose, and the effect is one of engagement mixed with thoughtful commitment to self. Its gravitas makes us recognize all the more how much Phil is defined by the superficial, the instantaneous, and the vacuous. Perhaps we're not surprised then to hear Chuck Close insisting in 1972, despite his art's exclusive focus on portraiture, quote, "I'm not concerned with painting people or with making humanist paintings," end quote. Photorealism, I'm saying, is a mode of painting surfaces rather than essences. But we should want to know why such a mode of working suddenly became credible at the end of the 60s. Indeed, for some, became the only credible way of painting. And furthermore, what such a mode entailed as philosophy and as politics. Why surface? And what does surface have to do with truth? For that matter, why reject interiority in the first place? Is it out of deference to the vast reaches of experience that cannot be known? Or is it, on the contrary, a declaration of the fundamental emptiness of creatures and of things? To answer some of these questions, my talk will consider surface as the primary device of photorealist painting. I'll focus today on the work of the great California photorealist Robert Bechtel. But I want first to spend a few minutes with examples by three other painters in the hopes of beginning to elucidate the roles of surface and of posing in photorealist painting. Consider Richard Estes' 1974 painting, Miami Rug Company. What I think this painting urgently reveals is the sheer domination in contemporary capitalist experience of surface. The image is dominated by plate glass windows, accented by strips of polished chrome left over from Miami's Art Deco heyday. These surfaces are further accompanied by the metal of street signs and traffic lights, together with the black architectural steel of the pedestrian shopping overpass. While Estes paintings, when seen in person, do have a decidedly painterly quality to them, they certainly emphasize sheen and reflection. Estes has exaggerated the brilliance at the base of the central crosswalk signal, for example, and has overexposed the street and sidewalk. He's borrowed the gloss of photography to help with this, as well as the sharpness of the Florida sun. In photorealism, as you'll see, the weather is always sunny. What's especially remarkable is the degree to which the painting, through an emphasis on reflection, turns even asphalt, concrete, and stone away from weight and substance and toward a feeling of planarity, even of appliqué. This overall effect, it seems to me, depends on found architectural details as well, especially the unrelenting shallowness, as for example, at the building on the other side of the street, at the right of the picture, of window frames throughout the painting. Or, consider Ralph Goings' painting, Walt's Restaurant. This painting is a corrective to, or at least some kind of post-war critical revision of Edward Hopper's rather sentimental, but extremely well-known painting, Nighthawks. We should ask, in what senses is Goings more committed to surface than Hopper? To begin with, there are the different kinds of matter depicted. In Hopper, brick, stone, and plaster. In Goings, linoleum, formica, wallboard, sheet metal, and plastic. Such differences are historical, of course. They actually accord to real differences in restaurant architecture between the 40s and the 70s. But the resulting effect, in any case, is an emphasis in Goings' painting on thinness, on objects that are light, almost nothing but surface. The counter and the stools and Hopper look almost like ship's oak by comparison. And the painters also handle their respective substances quite differently. Hopper's light is dramatic and harsh, but it seems absorbed by its objects. Goings intensifies the effect of surface by insisting everywhere instead on reflectivity. Door, pinball machine, tables, floor, everything seems to turn back the light, acting almost like an array of mirrors. One might add that Goings rejects the elemental sense of abiding reality in Hopper. Hopper's composition is highly stable. The counter gives his painting and its figures a shared focal area. Goings, by contrast, constructs the diner so that it pulls itself apart architectonically, prominently including foreground chairs that face away both from the center of the painting and from the direction of the man's stare. There are splotches in the sheen on the floor, the door is open, and one chair needs pushing in. This is a painting, then, not only of surfaces, but also of contingency, that is to say, of the momentary arrangement of things, of a kind of momentary fleetingness. Goings has underlined his rejection of any essential revelation by drawing his title not from the place pictured, but instead, as if mechanically, from words that happen to appear across the street in a sign for another establishment altogether, Walt's Restaurant. So I realize maybe no one can see this, but the painting is called Walt's Restaurant, and it's this restaurant here that's called Walt's Restaurant, which is legible in the sign across the street. And this, interestingly, it's not just going, several other photorealist painters did this. They would name paintings after words that happened to appear in the painting. It's true of Miami Rug Company, by the way, rather than of something that's actually at the center of what's being represented, as if somehow the computer had scanned it for you or something and come up with the title. Okay, enough for now on surface. Another topic of photorealism, and a related one, is posing. A pose, as adopted traditionally for portrait painters, is an effort to convey one's essence, or rather an ideal version of one's essence for the painter to capture. For reasons of the photograph's qualities of instantaneousness and of indifference, The word pose, when applied to something done for a camera, usually refers to a rather faster, but also more complicated phenomenon. The photographic pose is still an effort to project an ideal, but it's quite often also a betrayal. Posing for a photograph means submitting oneself to the fact that the effort will also likely be captured, that the ideal will be blended with the traces of its projection. Just as the film is exposed, so is the sitter in the picture. Hence, we get the common criticism of a family snapshot, which we would rarely say of a painted portrait, that it looks posed. This usually means a picture in which the act of self-presentation comes through, as it does rather dramatically in Richard MacLean's Dial-Is of 1971. This painting, like MacLean's others from the period, is based on a photograph from an equestrian magazine. The subject is the eponymous mare, a moderately successful Oklahoma quarter horse. To make the image, the man and the woman, even the horse, face the camera. They pause for a moment. The horse is positioned to look regal, its owner's smile to look satisfied. The original photograph, which I unfortunately, despite hours and hours of looking in the Library of Congress, I have not found, but the original photograph, no doubt, was meant as confirmation of these expected meanings. The horse is a good one, and its owners are accordingly pleased. But the pose also captured many details irrelevant to this central content: the awkward fit of the man's pants, the protruding clip of his glasses case, the garish modern design of the woman's blouse. And further details extend the clash of meanings: the slight embarrassment in the woman's bodily performance of feminine modesty, and the man's contrived smile put on while squinting against the sun. All these things are the accidental meanings, the meanings out of step with the photograph's original photojournalistic purpose. Through the basic act of copying and enlarging the original photograph onto canvas, MacLean transforms these forgettable and overlooked accidents into the central content of his painting. To these, we might add finally the modest planter at the center of the background, loosely occupied as it is by drab bushes at either end. It's the trace of an effort to invest a place with appropriate meanings, and of the inevitable limit of such efforts. In the place of elegance, we have leaves, dirt, and rusticated brick. I call attention to this planter not because it betrays any true modesty beneath the effort to look triumphant. I don't think MacLean is trafficking in true and false. And by the way, I'll just say parenthetically, I think this has been one of the head fakes of photorealism, scholarship on photorealism, right? I think it's fundamentally not actually preoccupied with true and false. It's actually much more preoccupied with differences between depth and surface, or abiding reality and apparent reality, or something like that. Anyway, I call attention to the planter not because I think it betrays any true modesty beneath the effort to look triumphant, but rather because it seems to me that it encapsulates the effort to conjure and control meanings, the difficulty of producing desired meanings in a world that exceeds, overflows, and contradicts them. The grounds are to be handsome, but they must be made so against nature. Our efforts at meaning must be mounted largely against reality. To mean is necessarily to pose. Robert Bechtel's Agua Caliente Nova of 1975 is based on a photograph that the artist took of his own family. Nancy Bechtel and the children, Max and Anne, are shown with the car that gives the painting its name. They're posing for their father, but poorly. Nancy is looking away from the camera, her eyes are behind sunglasses, and her face is anyway fully in shadow. The children do look toward their father, that is to say, knowingly toward the artist, toward the camera, toward the viewers of both the snapshot and the future painting, even that is to say, toward us. Squinting against the sun, however, their eyes are, like their mother's, in shadow. In fact, with the exception of a tiny spot of white in Anne's right eye, anyway outshone by the reflections off her glasses, their eyes are altogether invisible. Their posture suggests that they feel fatigued or put upon by the journey and by their father's request for a pose. Taken a moment too early or too late, this is not an image for the family photo album. It simply does not communicate enough, or maybe more precisely, the wealth of what it does communicate is just too mundane and disorganized. If Bechtel's prominent inclusion of the parking lot strikes a blow against Ansel Adams' version, for example, of pristine desert wilderness, the painting is not merely deflationary or ironic. On the contrary, it communicates enthusiasm for the beauty of this minor landmark in the Agua Caliente Indian Reservation near Palm Springs. The yellow midground grasses, the reddish-brown scree just behind it, the light green of the more distant hills in comparison with the lush valley below, these have all been painted with care. Of course, Bechtel was not the first to make a large oil painting from a mundane family photograph. Edgar Degas' Place de la Concorde of 1876 is actually a remarkably similar painting. A parent, the artist Ludovic Lepic, stares distractedly off the right edge of the canvas while a pair of children, loosely united by posture and mood, seem both to comply with and to resist a parental program. Degas' painting, like Bechtel's, makes a classically balanced composition out of the momentary and disorganized disposition of bodies in space. Both painters, too, have deployed large fields of yellow-brown. Desert parking lot or new urban square, the situation leaves the figures adrift in empty space. Degas' space is actually flatter, even emptier and looser than Bechtel's desert. But remarkably, the paintings are united by their sense of photographic contingency. That is to say, the Lepic family, like Bechtel's, is caught at a moment of failing to coherently represent itself. If they're smartly matching, the Lepics look quite unfocused. What we do not yet see in Degas' painting, however, is the hardness and specificity of the photographic instant. If the father's hat awkwardly overlaps for a moment with one of the sculptural urns at the periphery of the square, his expression and those of the other figures remain general in a painterly way. Bechtel's figures, by contrast, have all the stiff, instantaneous rigidity of having slightly failed to pose for the camera, of having been captured, that is, in 1/60th of a second. In Agua Caliente Nova, as in Bechtel's paintings generally, the sun seems to have worked as a fixing agent, almost like a deadly atomic flash. The painting recalls a remark by Edward Abbey about the desert written in this period. Quote, "Only the sunlight holds things together. Noon is the crucial hour. The desert reveals itself nakedly and cruelly with no meaning but its own existence," end quote. Strong light gives a superficial effect of coherence to a world of disparate and meaningless surfaces. And this brings me to the major point I want to make here. If Degas' painting can be said to be about flatness, the confusing absence of pictorial depth, the paint as rough matter on canvas, Bechtel's painting, by contrast, is instead about surfaces. After all, Bechtel's picture is not especially flat. In fact, the receding hills and the bodies of the two cars give it a fairly deep shape. Rather, it is a painting about skin, clothing, and reflections, about chrome and bulldozed earth. Quite unlike Degas, it is furthermore built emphatically around the voids beneath these many surfaces. It is about the empty volume behind the steel and glass skin of its automobiles, about the dry California air. When I say that Bechtel's paintings are about surface, then, I don't mean to associate them especially with the surface of modernist formalism, that is to say, the surface of the canvas itself. I mean instead that they are about a new experience of surfaces as an important dissection of the history of post-war life. In Sacramento, Montego of 1980, we see a characteristic Bechtel subject, a suburban car lightly in contact with a human figure. These figures are usually families or individual men, and they're always, to my knowledge, white. Although we're offered a traditionally engaging composition with raking perpendicular diagonals and a light asymmetry, the painting is again explicitly about amateur photography. It carefully reproduces the mediocrity of a snapshot made by inexpert use of the camera and automated printing. The back of the car is bleached out by a sunburst reflection, while the garden, the house, and especially the man's face are underexposed to the point of obscurity. Most of what should be important or interesting in the picture, therefore, is in fact difficult to make out. Nevertheless, this is again a painting about posing, that battle against disorder, about what one does with a car, with a garden, with a camera to promote a vision of coherence and control. Once again, the photograph as fixing agent has both promised to help in this effort and also betrayed it. Much in this picture depends on the central figure. His posture, together with what we can glean about his facial expression, communicates the effect of his being slightly worn, half relaxed, and perhaps barely proud. Typically, the man's eyes are invisible, and his indefinite expression is rendered obscurely. The person represented is Ralph Goings, Bechtel's colleague and friend, but nothing tells us that this is an artist or even an acquaintance. The painting remains a kind of anti-portrait. The sitter's identity is not self-possessed and coherent, but rather, for all we can see, centerless, possibly even hollow. The painting is also insistent about the serial organization of its particular stage of later modernity. That is, it forthrightly represents a new post-war fabric of tract homes, together with their gardens and the cars that make them possible. And Sacramento Montego does not simply state the cliché of this landscape's novelty and strangeness. It presses especially on that landscape's vocabulary of surfaces, its thin, linear planarity. Consider the slenderness in the house's cantilevered roof, in its prefabricated wooden exterior walls, and in its horizontally sliding aluminum windows. These surfaces are echoed by the car's light, molded shell of steel, glass, and synthetic leather. All these forms are industrial skins, belonging to a stage of modernity defined by ever thinner surfaces, surfaces with voids behind them. Bechtel's interest is not in the cheapness per se of these materials, nor in their artificiality. As a painter and as a photographer, as well as a late modern, he insists instead upon this landscape's dedication to surface. Bechtel's art, it seems to me, suggests furthermore that the car, suburb, and snapshot all belong to the same sub-history of later modernity. All are oriented to thin surfaces, and all are means for posing. And I'll just say parenthetically, gardens, which are less historically specific, right? I mean, gardens are ancient, also participate in this dynamic, right? They are devices for making an appearance. All these spheres of human activity are mechanisms for projecting appearances, appearances in tension with essences that are now increasingly in doubt. Bechtel's photorealism, furthermore, articulates the links between the material and the epistemic aspects of this recent history. That is to say, if essential truth no longer seems credible, if representation now must amount to a complete recording of appearances, this development belongs to a world built by photographs and light synthetics. Plastics were a covert subject of photorealism. I say covert because plastics were, in fact, relatively rarely represented. But the orientation toward thin surfaces that I've been pointing to cannot be historically understood, it seems to me, without some reference to plastics, as they constituted the single greatest remaking of the material culture of modernity in the decades after World War II. Thin, strong, disposable, and hollow, petroleum-based synthetics became the definitive surface of the most recent stage of capitalism. Exceptional in its direct address of such new materials is Watsonville Chairs, which might be understood as an essay on the varied textures and colors of consumer plastics. It appears to picture, and this is a little bit fudged, and if anyone's an expert, you can help me, but it appears to picture a vinyl umbrella with synthetic decorative string, a Formica outdoor tabletop, and a horizontal yellow band of corrugated plastic fencing. And then, of course, there are the four eponymous chairs in metal frames. Two are foam stuffed and vinyl wrapped. One for children is woven in plaid polyester fabric, another in slick PVC. With our few decades of distance, It can be difficult to remember just how quickly and thoroughly plastics transformed the consumer landscape in the 30 years after World War II. The historian Jeffrey L. Mikely has pointed out that the baby boomers, unlike young people in any previous generation, quote, ate breakfast from mica dinettes, spilled milk from polyethylene tumblers onto vinyl floors, and left for school clutching disposable Bic pens, end quote. Vinyl siding, not available until 1964, had already been used on 250,000 houses by the middle of the 70s in the United States. But of course, the major photorealists were a bit older than boomers. For them, this plastics age was a novelty. Theirs was a world in which plastics rapidly began to carry a variety of metaphoric meanings. Among other things, the victory of surface over essence, as one retrospective commentator put it. In the San Francisco counterculture of the 1960s, the term plastic famously stood for phoniness in general, and dictionaries began accommodating such meanings by the early 1970s. Meanwhile, Tom Wolfe wrote derisively of, quote, $8,000 bungalows with plastic accordion folding partitions and the baby asleep in a foldaway crib of plastic net, end quote. Now, Bechtel did note that a realist painter should be, quote, interested in the substance and texture of everyday life as it exists right now, end quote. But my point here is hardly to suggest that he or any other photorealists were great critics of the rise of plastic. Nothing in their paintings suggests any particular antipathy for plastics on health, environmental, or even cultural historical grounds. Rather, I just mean to suggest that a new landscape of thin shells captured the attention of these painters, and that it found a meaningful parallel in their preoccupation with snapshots and slides. Indeed, plastic's unusual conundrum of being both highly disposable and highly permanent, it is the thing you throw away immediately but that never biodegrades, did make it structurally analogous in a loose way to photography. The latter technology is both beholden precisely to the moment, in a way that painting never had been, and oriented above all to memory, to the passing of years and generations. I'd like to continue for a moment with this idea that plastics and photography were in some way analogous forms, because I suspect that it is in this analogy that photorealism is most historically telling. Consider that photography, like plastic, is defined in part by its orientation to surface. As a medium, it has quite a different relationship to the surface-depth dialectic than does painting. The fundamental challenge of painting, the difficult task that animates it, is that while being a flat surface, it must conjure illusionistic depth. Chiaroscuro, the layering of color, and other forms of modeling are brought on precisely because of the difficulty of overcoming the fact that the canvas is a surface. Photography, a record of surfaces, has no such difficulty. It is superficial from the start. The film receives light from surfaces and effortlessly records them in two dimensions. This orientation to surface was especially notable in the great period of about 1955 to 2005 of the printed amateur snapshot. Polaroids, drugstore prints, even 35 millimeter slides, these were not expensive objects to be mounted to an album or a picture frame, but rather light and thin ephemera, surfaces to be flipped and shuffled in one's hand. Part of what animated photorealism, what made it compelling for a few years, was its desire to graft this photographic mode of vision, this plain and equal recording of surfaces, onto the historical form of painting. I think photorealism was an effort to see how these two ways of looking and their attendant metaphysics might work things out together. It was a means of asking what the recording of surfaces might add to or subtract from the painterly effort to represent deep truths. It seems to me that the best of photorealism doubts both the view that the world is deeply meaningful and also the apparently nihilistic alternative view that nothing exists but matter and surface. So consider the man, we've been ignoring him until now, in the foreground of Watsonville chairs. I think this figure, with his shaded face and invisible eyes, the hot spots of reflection off his glasses and his head, goes some way to help us understand the dynamics in photorealism that link photography, plastics, gardens, and architecture with the representation of the human being. Here's a man at the edge of the picture facing out of it. We sense that he's one of a group and probably not the central figure in it. In other words, our painting is a picture not just of surfaces, but also of margins. The reality in this painting is contingent, a light disorder of chairs caught in an arrangement that cannot have lasted more than a few hours. And it is one in which significance is suspended or maybe irrelevant. Things appear, they face our vision totally, unblinkingly, but they have very little to tell us. We know everything and nothing. Photography has completed our vision, given us more information than we ever knew to ask for, but we are more uncertain of truth than ever. This brings us to the final question of this talk. What was photorealism's relationship to humanism? As I've been suggesting, photorealism amounted to an anti-humanism, but it was an anti-humanism of a rather unusual and complicated kind. It seems to me that we need to be rather subtle in our characterization of photorealism's relationship to the larger so-called anti-humanist turn taken by art in the later 1960s. Let's consider the wonderful and very large Roses of 1973. This painting depicts three women, in fact, Bechtel's sister-in-law, wife, and mother, conversing on a tidy new sidewalk. The location is a suburban cul-de-sac in Dublin, California. Two of the women hold drinks. All three are clad in dresses and skirts, as if for a semi-formal party of some kind. We have the feeling that the women have briefly come out of the house, barely pictured in the left background, perhaps expressly to admire the pink flowers of the title. The rendering is in Bechtel's mature and assured photorealist style. Everything is clear without being crisp. The measured inexactness of the painting, which is visible even from several feet away, does not recapitulate a photographic blur, but rather belongs specifically to painting. There's nothing of the trompe l'oeil about it. It's simply the flat matte effect of unvarnished oil paint, and it communicates that what we have before us, even if derived from film, is a canvas. This painting, like others we've seen by Bechtel, contrasts formality with the temporary and immediate, with the contingent. And it furthermore connects photography to gardening as analogous efforts to make order of the world, to fix it and tidy it, to make it look a certain way. The painting also characteristically deposits its figures in a sea of surfaces, surrounding them with fresh concrete, automotive steel, frond plants, canvas car covers, and two kinds of thin garden fencing. Sunlight, again, makes the faces of these things seem especially smooth and eventlessly planar. The architectural context is all wall and fence, and the painting offers no visual means of access to the deep interior of the house. The roses are an emblem of striving for an ideal form of visibility, to be sure, but the painting does not mock or even ironize this effort. The roses are in fact lovely specimens, and the women, while not on a grand estate, are assuredly at leisure on a gorgeous day. It's the glances that make the painting. As usual, we hardly see the eyes. The women do not make eye contact. Two of them gaze in the direction of the flowers, seeming to look not so much at as vaguely past them, while Nancy Bechtel looks out at her husband, the photographer. There is the suggestion, perhaps, of some small psychological gaps of the work involved in maintaining the social links of family. Note the slight physical separation of the sister in yellow, together with the mild bashfulness of her stance, or the mismatch between Nancy's neo-hippie casualness and the post-mod dresses of the other two. My point is not that this painting amounts to an essay on suburban misery. On the contrary, Roses is about its own withholding, about what it does not or cannot show. This particular composition of poses and glances, arrived at with the help of a shutter, refuses to attempt any account of the true character of the women or of their relationships. More specifically, this is a painting of appearances. In a statement made the year he painted roses, Bechtel wrote, quote, "I've always been interested in how things looked. Something of substance is to be found in the details of appearance," end quote. While remaining with the appearance of things, however, Roses neither contends that appearances are false, nor seems quite to believe that they are all there is. Rather, the painting restricts itself to the visible, to the surfaces that can be recorded, even while teetering on the edge of wondering whether we might have means for discovering some deeper reality beneath. Compare, finally, Nancy Bechtel's indefinite expression before the camera to the more familiar anti-humanist hollowness we often see in Andy Warhol's screen tests. Of course, the screen tests, those fantastically relentless short movie portraits shot on 16mm film, have no single philosophy of the human being. That's part of the brilliance of Warhol's works. But in general, Warhol's laboratory conditions for the screen tests ended up showing the sitters' identities as either desperately performed or simply evacuated. The sheer emptiness of Richard Rehm, for example, is chilling. Bechtel, although his art also turns people into surfaces, shows identity instead as a continually deferred promise of depth, as something we hope to find, but which even our best means of representation cannot deliver to us. It seems to me that one of the great unanswered questions of art history is why realist painting was so thoroughly and permanently discredited by modernism, while the realist novel remains our dominant form of literature. Certainly the answer has to do with the camera, and with the fact that the camera ended up establishing a new and uniquely authoritative mode of visual representation. The camera promised, in a way that literature never could, access to a world described as surface, a mode of vision both indiscriminate and complete. But the indiscriminate is also the undiscriminating, even the undiscerning. It cannot and will not do. The cold and depthless vision of the camera, especially when loaded with color film, is the most complete vision of the world we have ever had. But it is a vision at odds with painting and with painting's sense of truth. To paint a snapshot in oil is to ask the epistemology of surface to confront the epistemology of depth. We can be thankful that in the best of photorealism, that competition is never over. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.